Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.
And time now to talk to Stephen Davis about the fate of British Airways Flight 149 back in 1990. He's written a book about this fascinating story. It's called Operation Trojan Horse. And I'm delighted to welcome Stephen all the way from New Zealand. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, how are you? It's evening here at 8:30.
Do you know, I people say that if you drilled a hole through the centre of the earth, you would arrive in Australia. But that's not true, apparently, of us here where we are in southern Spain. If we drilled a hole, we would pop up just outside Wellington, apparently.
That's absolutely correct. Yes, I'm pretty much the other side of the world, but happy to be here.
Well, that's an interesting time to talk to you, isn't it, Stephen, about being in New Zealand. Only very recently we saw that New Zealand were locking down the entire country over one case of COVID.
Yes, we have a strategy which they followed from the start of elimination. And it's actually very popular with Kiwis, an overwhelming support. I mean, New Zealand society, if we have a lockdown, I have to say, compared with other parts of the world, New Zealand is locked down. The streets are empty and we take it seriously. And it's been a good trade-off. If you want to look at it this way, in the last year, we've had two short, sharp lockdowns, which were complete lockdowns. And the whole of the rest of the time, no COVID in the community and leading a completely normal life. So if the trade-off is 46 weeks of normal life and 6 weeks of lockdown a year, I think New Zealanders would take that every time, as opposed to, for instance, countries like our Australian friends in Sydney,
yeah,
who took sort of half measures and rather than have one short sharp lockdown and then get rid of it and return to normal, they've got months of strife.
They have, and they've got people rioting in the streets. I mean, it couldn't be a more different look, could it?
No, it couldn't. Luckily enough, you know, New Zealand is not a perfect country. I'm a little biased, obviously. We're a small country. We're sometimes considered to be too parochial. But one of the nice things about New Zealand is our political discourse is still pretty moderate compared with other countries, Australia, the UK, the US. We don't tend to have the extremes. We have a few anti-vaccine people. We have a few anti-lockdown people. But most New Zealanders believe in science and most New Zealanders believe in facts. And you know, the absence of political extremism is welcome, quite frankly.
And I think also you're kind of unique in the fact that your Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, is so well liked and respected in the country.
Yes, I mean, the interesting thing about Jacinda is, of course, when she took over, there were a lot of doubts about what kind of leader she would be. She was put to the test straight away by the appalling Christchurch massacre, which was a real shock to New Zealanders. We've never had anything like that before. So I would point out that the person was an Australian who did it, not a New Zealander.
Yes.
But she has shown impressive leadership, not least by explaining things clearly. Mm. I listened to some other politicians talk about the virus and lockdowns and things, and it's bordering on incoherent.
Boris Johnson, you might be talking about there.
Yes. Well, I'm hoping that some British Conservatives will buy my book, so perhaps I won't go there.
Fair enough.
You know, she developed a policy, she explained it properly, a four-level system, and that's what we followed. And as I said, you know, we're in a lockdown at the moment. We'll get rid of it soon because the degree of compliance is almost total. And then we'll probably have many more months of completely normal life. I'm able to enjoy the rugby and alongside crowds of people.
Well, thank you for talking about that. A nice kind of aside to our main chat, really, about this book that you've written. And I'm a huge plane fan, and I was not aware of this story of BA-149 back on the 1st of August 1990. It was a scheduled flight destined for Kuala Lumpur. It had nearly 400 passengers on board, and it never made it to Kuala Lumpur. And one would have thought that this story would be all over the news and everybody would be very familiar with it, but we're not.
No, and there's a very good reason for that, as I explain in Operation Trojan Horse, where I reveal a number of secrets. I won't talk about them all now because I actually want people to buy the book. But this speaks to the success of the British government and British Airways in covering up what happened for 30 years. And this cover-up included threats and intimidation to me while writing a book, to British Airways staff who tried to talk about it and write books. You know, sadly, there is still a culture of state secrecy in the UK. They have the Draconian Official Secrets Act. They have all other sorts of weapons to use against proper investigations. And they have, as you said, most people do not realise that the plane landed, that its passengers were taken hostage and used as human shields, passengers and crew, that they were treated appallingly in captivity, and for many of them it ruined their lives. Yeah. It is truly a shocking scandal.
And to kind of paint the picture for our listeners, we're in August 1990, and the British and American governments had very clear intelligence that Saddam was about to invade, yet they proceeded with plans to refuel in Kuwait City, even as all the other flights around them were rerouted, which is very strange in itself. But the answers are even stranger. Margaret Thatcher was in power at the time. Can you tell us a little bit about who you talked to for this book and how honest they could be with you and whether anybody could go on the record?
Yes. So, I mean, initially, as you say, it was clear Saddam Hussein was going to invade. Indeed, as passengers and crew drove to the airport that morning for their flight, the BBC was reporting a huge massing of Iraqi troops on the border. So, as you said, the plane flies, it lands. All other flights were turned away. There was a Captain Matuk bringing in a Kuwaiti Airlines 747 who was contacted by the control tower in Kuwait, and they said, divert to Bahrain, you can't land here. Mm. The invasion starts when 149 is 4 hours, 3.5 or 4 hours flying time, depending on how you count the start of the invasion from Kuwait, and it's allowed to fly on, land in a war zone, and get everybody captured. Now, this is an official secret. This is a secret black ops operation, essentially. Wow. And in that area, I've had a lot of experience in reporting on the intelligence services and special forces for other investigations. One of the great difficulties is, of course, getting people to talk to you, even off the record. Mm. Bear in mind that in talking to me, my sources are risking jail time. They're risking their careers. They're risking their pensions. Mm. Many years ago, I did another story about a former MI6 agent called Richard Tomlinson, and for the sins of talking to the press and trying to write a book, he was banged up in Belmarsh Prison in London for 9 months. All of my sources for this book, you know, risked a great deal to tell me their stories. In particular, I would like to meet my last and best source, who I was able to name, a man called Tony Pace, who was the MI6 station chief in Kuwait City at the time of the invasion and landing. Tony appeared at the press conference alongside me to call for an inquiry and launch the book. And this is a very, very brave man, because he was doing so, and what he was saying to me was in breach of the Official Secrets Act, and he would potentially face a jail term. God. But out of conscience and the desire to tell the truth, he agreed to come forward, and I appreciate that.
I mentioned Margaret Thatcher there, and this was all about, for want of a better expression, an exchange of favours at the highest echelons of government and a kind of secret, unaccountable organisation, which she authorised. And the reason you've called the book what you have is that the plane basically was a Trojan horse, which was to sneak in a group of intelligence officers into Kuwait aboard the flight, hence why they stopped off at that time to refuel in Kuwait. Now, okay, you sneak in some intelligence officers, but you're effectively then using the rest of the passengers as collateral damage, aren't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They were using them as cover to get the team in. And this was Mrs. Thatcher's, by the way, drove this mission right from the start.
Yeah.
It was her thing. And having had the plane land and the people captured, except for the mystery team who got away, she proceeded to give one of the most deceptive statements I think ever given to the House of Commons a month later, where she was asked about 149 and why it had landed. So here is the Prime Minister of the country speaking to the House of Commons, and she says the plane landed, the people got off, the reserve crew got on, it was refueled and ready to take off. All of this landed, all of this happened before the invasion. And then on camera, you can see her turn to her backbenchers and emphasize before the invasion.
Mm.
That is 100% wrong. Every bit of that statement is totally untrue. The invasion happened 4 hours flying time from Kuwait. And indeed, I have the intelligence flash message, which went to London and Washington, reporting exactly when Iraqi troops crossed the border. So I think it's one of the most deceptive statements ever made to the Commons, and let's face it, that would be a long list.
Yeah, I mean, the cover-up is extraordinary. The passengers obviously had no knowledge of what was going on here. Did the pilots have any knowledge? Surely not, then, otherwise they would have refused to have flown it.
Well, it turns out that Richard Bunyat, the captain, was an asset for British intelligence.
Goodness me.
I was told by my sources that the one person you would have to tell about the mission was the captain,
yeah,
because, of course, he could have at any time turned around the plane. And it is clear to me, by the way, that British Airways right from the start participated in the cover-up. They were very determined not to allow the truth to come out, to the extent of threatening their own staff who tried to write books. And there's a key moment, and this comes back to my MI6 contact, Tony Pace, about British Airways saying they were told it was safe to fly and they flew. Mm. And that turns out not to be true. So not only does the British government have a case to answer, but British Airways absolutely does. And I know, having met a lot of their crew, the surviving crew who I met at the reunion, and the passengers, they're pretty disgusted at the behaviour of BA.
I'm not surprised. So tell us the kind of chronology of what happened then. So the plane arrives, the passengers, I guess, were expecting to stay on the plane while it was refueled and then head off to Kuala Lumpur. What happened next?
Yes, so it was a refueling stop, of course. A few people got off, including the mystery team who was summoned to the front of the plane and disappeared. Most people stayed on the plane,
yeah,
while it was being refueled. Wouldn't it be allowed to happen now, of course?
No, indeed.
Apparently in those days you could. Some of them got off to stretch their legs in the terminal, but couldn't help noticing how empty it was and how there were no planes around. Just at this crucial moment, when this 747 is being filled full of aviation fuel, people see planes are zipping across the airport and bombs dropping. And the Iraqis started bombing the airport.
Goodness.
And the people on the plane, of course, their initial feeling is we're a bomb ready to go off. One stray bit and we explode. So there was this tremendously panicky evacuation. They all got off. And then they're milling around the terminal, not knowing what's happening. They're taken to an airport hotel, and the next thing they look out the window, and as one described to me, there were Iraqi tanks as far as the eye could see, and then they knew they were in real trouble.
Goodness me. And so they were taken hostage by the Iraqis, I guess pretty swiftly then, but their treatment under the Iraqis was variously mistreatment, near starvation conditions, even sexual assault. And many of them, as we've mentioned, would go on to be used by Iraq as human shields. This should have been like the top story on all of our news bulletins and an absolute scandal. It's really staggering that this was able to be covered up in such a way. What were we told at the time was going on when these people were paraded on the telly?
Okay, so the general feeling was early on the Foreign Office gave a spin that don't worry, it's a sort of extended holiday and they're in nice hotels in Kuwait. They're probably sipping cocktails by the pool in the sunshine. Well, for a few days, they were in nice hotels in Kuwait. Then they were scattered to about 70 strategic sites throughout Iraq and Kuwait. These were the places where Saddam thought the Allies might bomb as they tried to kick him out of Kuwait.
Yeah.
And so that was where they faced human shields. They were literally human shields against bombing. Thatcher made it clear that it wouldn't stop any military action. So most of these people thought, if the Iraqis don't kill us, then our own side will by bombing us. They were held at electrical power plants, dams. Ironically enough, this is when Saddam actually had weapons of mass destruction programs. So some of them were held at nuclear facilities and biological warfare facilities. And as you said, treated completely appallingly.
Yeah.
For months on end. Now, you ask a very interesting question about why we really didn't seize on this.
Yeah.
So I was on the news desk of The Independent on Sunday, a paper that I helped to launch as one of the launch editorial team.
Right.
And what happened was, of course, events. You know, we journalists were swept up in events. So sure. No sooner had the plane landed and they were taken hostage, then it became this tremendous countdown for war. You remember George Bush assembling his grand coalition of countries.
Yes.
Drawing a line in the sand, saying this will not stand, egged on by Thatcher. And then in the build-up to the whole war, that's what we were concentrating on. And I'm afraid we more or less forgot these poor people.
Goodness me. And do we know about the special forces surveillance operatives who were effectively put there to feed back intelligence? What happened to them? Did they get carted off somewhere separately and were able to do their job, or were they also locked away?
Actually, two of them got picked up by Iraqis but managed to talk the way out of it. In the early days of the invasion, it was very chaotic. There were some elite Iraqi troops there, Republican Guard, etc., and right. Hardline Baathists. But there were also a number of very poorly trained draftees, conscripts, who people noticed their uniforms were bad, they barely had enough to eat, they looked bored and disinterested. So they were lucky enough to get picked up by a less alert lot. The other teams did their job and delivered valuable intelligence back to London and Washington. And I've spoken to a couple of them, and they're actually proud of the mission itself, although they are extremely sorry for the passengers who got caught up in it.
And here we are now, all these years later, and this story is not only in your book, but is now common knowledge, effectively, because of things like your book. These people on that plane must be seething mad that this had happened to start with, and there has been no apology that we can see to those passengers who were actually mistreated by the British government and used as shields, effectively. They knew what their fate was going to be, and they sent them to it.
Yeah, I the reason I wrote and have persisted in my determination to get Operation Trojan Horse out there, my book, and get it published was I'm driven on by the appalling treatment dealt out to these people. And now they want an apology. After 30 years, yeah. There's no earthly national security grounds in saying, pretend the mission didn't happen.
Sure.
It's all history now. They want an apology. It's also worth remembering that these people suffered in two separate ways. First off, they were landed in a war zone as an intentional act. But secondly, the British government After they all came back, commissioned a report. It was done by the Royal Military Police. It was done at great cost. It was called Operation Sandcastle, and it involved interviewing 1,700 former Human Shields, those that had arrived on the plane and many who were trapped on the ground because they'd been living and working in Kuwait.
Right.
This report portrays a horror story of what happened to them. No sooner had the report arrived in the government's desk than they suppressed it, declared a secret, refused to release it to Parliament, and 30 years later, it is still a secret. It was due out. We were widely informed at the end of the 30-year rule last year. It's been postponed. It's still not come out. The only reason, of course, they don't want the report to come out is because, well, at least before my book was published, they didn't want people to know of the terrible things that happened to the Human Shields and then start asking questions about why they ended up there in the first place. Uh-huh. So I hope with Operation Trojan Horse, I brought some measure. Well, I know I've had a fantastic response from the Human Shields, but I think now we need the release of the report, yeah. Sandcastle,
yeah.
And we need an apology.
Absolutely. And, you know, again, the timing of this is extraordinary as we talk about British governments deceiving their own people and using them for their own purposes, as we have this bizarre situation, you know, in Afghanistan now with the clock ticking away. As a journalist, you must be looking at that in abject horror, I would think.
In abject horror, but also given what I discovered in Trojan Horse, with a great deal of interest.
Yep.
Well, one of the reasons the mission was covered up was the misuse of its intelligence. So bear in mind that after Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, there was a fear only, that he would go on to invade Saudi Arabia and seize the Saudi oil fields.
Yeah.
And as a result of that fear, Dick Cheney and Norman Schwarzkopf went to Saudi and they persuaded the Saudi king to allow American troops on Saudi soil. That was a few days after the plane landed.
Right.
Now, they did it on the basis that Saddam was threatening Saudi.
Yep.
But in fact, the intelligence was saying the exact opposite.
Mm.
The intelligence was saying they were digging in defensive positions. There were satellite photos which showed them nowhere near the border. The Saudis themselves sent scout troops across the border and couldn't find any Iraqis. So this misuse of intelligence led to this historic decision to have American troops on Saudi soil. And as I say in my book, and I quote Dick Clark, top State Department official, this decision angered a Saudi who had gone to the king with his own offer to raise holy warriors to kick out Saddam Hussein. This Saudi, when American troops arrived on Saudi soil, swore revenge. Mm. A man called bin Laden, who had his revenge on 9/11, which then led directly to the Afghan invasion and 30 years of chaos.
Wow.
Dick Clark, as I said, an expert in the field, says in my book, there would have been no Afghanistan, no chaos, no failed states, probably no Syria, no Yemen. They all followed that one decision back in August 1990.
Goodness.
So this has a greater significance, far beyond just the suffering of these poor people.
How
and as I said, to repeat, and I've looked at all the documents of this. I've been looking at this for 15 years. This actually, whatever Cheney and Schwarzkopf said to the king, there's actually no evidence at all that that Iraqi troops were threatening Saudi Arabia, which was the basis for this history-changing decision.
Stephen, the thing about this is, you know, as we live in these strange and very troubled times where we're kind of relying on our governments, we've talked about Jacinda Ardern and her approach, and in the UK it's a very different approach. And once you realise, you know, that people consistently tell you lies in order to get what they want, you kind of end up mistrusting everything. You know, if it was your friends, you know, who you'd been lied to several times and you discovered the lies, you'd say, well, I'm not going to trust them ever again. And when things like this come out, it places a kind of it pulls the bottom out of the Jenga game a little bit, doesn't it? And all the wooden blocks fall to the ground on everything.
Yes, I mean, I think that all governments are prepared to lie when they think the national interest, and they convince themselves that it's better that it's kept a secret. The British government is particularly good at that, particularly secretive.
Yeah.
I think our attitude is different now, of course, because of the weapons of mass destruction fiasco in 2003. I was there. I covered that conflict. People asked me, somebody asked me quite recently why we didn't realise they were lying back in 1990. But 1990 was a different world.
Yeah.
After 2003, I think public confidence in Western government's use of intelligence and being honest about things pretty much collapsed and has never really recovered. And then, of course, followed by lots of other lies about lots of other things. I do think this, though, as somebody who's taken a big interest in politics and looked at what, happens in New Zealand and some other countries elsewhere, I do think, though, to some extent, that we get the governments and the politicians we deserve. Because if people came along and were completely honest and said, look, actually, you know what, we can't spend lots of money on all these things, or we have to raise your taxes by a great deal. Actually, government has limits and there's not a lot we can do about X, Y, and Z, and blah, blah, blah. If a politician came along and you know, that wonderful kind of West Wing style idealistic politician and was very honest with everybody, would they actually get elected? Would enough people actually vote for them?
Good question. Good question. Well, fascinating stuff. The book is on our website, tre.radio, in our bookstore. You can go and buy it there, say if you're looking around the internet for it. Operation Trojan Horse by Stephen Davis. Stephen, absolute pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you for coming on and giving your insights, not only to that, but into the situation in New Zealand. And we hope your lockdown doesn't last too long. You can all get back to your normality as soon as possible.
Yeah, well, I'm in managed isolation. I'm due out of my hotel room Sunday, so I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, bless you. Lovely to talk to you, Stephen. You take care of yourself.
Thanks very much.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Andy and Anna here from your new favourite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.